Next case, Megan, would you call it, please?
The court will now call Miller versus Day. May it please the court, Mr. Jack Strickland, arguing for the appellant, and Mr. Andy Porter, arguing for the state.
Sit down.
Good morning.
Mr. Strickland.
May it please the court. I'm pleased to see all of you here. Mr. Justice Brigham. Good to see you again, sir. I'm Jack Strickland from Fort Worth. I represent Wesley Wayne Miller, the appellant, in the cause of action before the court this morning. This appeal arises, or these appeals, because as the court notes, there are three cases on appeal before you today. These appeals arise from Criminal District Court Number 4 here in Tarrant County, in which the defendant pled guilty with the right of appeal certified by the trial court, following a denial of his motions to quash indictment filed in all three cases. Let me begin by telling you what this case is not about. And what it is not about is the constitutionality either as to the breadth or the application of this particular statute. I must admit to the court that had I been trial counsel in this case, perhaps the issues would have been framed a little bit differently than what we have here today. But regrettably, for whatever reason, that was not done, and so the question shall have to wait until another time and place, and I'm sure at some point it will arise, if not in the context of this case, some other case. The background of this case is fairly straightforward, although you wouldn't know that from the record, because I found the record to be confusing, whether that's a shortcoming on my part or whether or not, in fact, the record is confusing. It was difficult to see exactly what all was going on and where everyone was going. But essentially, the facts are these. Wesley Wayne Miller received two concurrent penitentiary sentences for offenses committed in Tarrant County in the early 1980s. He served those sentences, and following his discharge from the custody of the institutional division, he was found to be a sexually violent predator under the new law provided under the Health and Safety Code of the state of Texas. As such, as a sexually violent predator, he was then to be supervised by CSOT, which is the Council on Sexual Offender Treatment, and he had certain terms and conditions which he was obligated to follow during the course of that. That's a civil commitment, not a criminal commitment. During the course of his treatment, Mr. Miller was found, or at least was alleged to have violated one of the conditions of his supervision, alleging, we can't tell this from the indictment, but alleging from the record at the trial court, to have occurred in April of 2008. He was then jailed. He was charged with that offense, and he was indicted for that first violation in August of 2008. Thereafter, while he was confined in the Tarrant County Jail, Mr. Miller was alleged to have committed two additional violations, namely telephone contacts with his father and his brother. That resulted in two additional indictments being returned against Mr. Miller. So that's the background. All three of these offenses, or violations, which is a more proper description, I think, because these are not penal code violations or violations per se, but supervisory conditions of treatment, resulted in a plea of guilty followed by this appeal. The issues before the court are two, I would suggest. The first in regard to the first alleged violation, and that is whether that indictment gave Mr. Miller fair and adequate notice in intelligible language of the violation alleged against him. And we submit to the court that it did not. Number one, it makes no effort whatsoever other than to allege in global terms that there had been a violation as determined by CSOT without going into any identifying information, not the violation or the date of the violation itself, not the identity of the person with whom the violation was allegedly committed, nor any of the manner and means of the violation. It simply alleges that after the time that he was taken into custody, that a violation as determined by CSOT had occurred. The violation, quote, that CSOT alleges occurred, that determination was made after the time of the actual alleged violation. So the in addition to the other problems with the indictment, it's internally inconsistent, I would suggest to the court. It's our position that that renders that first indictment in the first of the three cases as an indictment which should have been quashed after the defendant had filed his timely and proper motion for quashal. The second two cases, alleged violations occurred while Mr. Miller was actually confined in the Tarrant County Jail, having been indicted and suspended from the CSOT program. He was no longer under the jurisdiction of CSOT at the time that the two second violations, which were alleged in the two subsequent cases, were committed. They were alleged to have committed in September and October. He was already in jail. He'd already been indicted on the first case. It's our position that this is an even easier circumstance. The Health and Safety Code clearly states that CSOT's jurisdiction over a sexually violent predator who has been transferred to their supervision ceases at such time as a violator is confined. There's no question from the record, from the law, that in fact Mr. Millard was confined. Inasmuch as he was confined.
So you can do things, your position is, you can do things when you're confined that you couldn't do when you were not confined.
Exactly. At least in terms of the violation of CSOT.
Does that make sense?
It doesn't make sense if you just phrase it in that global term, because that makes it sound like, well, you could murder somebody, and that would not be a violation of CSOT.
No, it would be a violation of some other things.
It would be a violation of other things. It might be a violation, for example, of the Texas Penal Code. It might be a violation of a protective order. It might be a violation.
I mean, your position is you cannot contact the victim. That you perpetrated an act on that sent you to prison. Oh, but by the way, if you get confined again, you can contact the victim.
You can contact the victim, and if you violate the law, that has repercussions.
But I know that contacting the victim would violate the law.
I'm not sure that it would.
Okay.
I'm not sure that it would. We may not like that.
No.
But nonetheless, it does not appear to fall under the authority of CSOT, who, after all, only has supervisory powers over people who are not confined. The criminal justice system will have to deal with that kind of conduct and contact if it is able to. Right? There's a variety of means by which that can be done.
Well, I know, but as you know, of course, the law is common sense. Common law came from common sense. This isn't making common sense.
Well,
that doesn't mean that you're wrong. I'm just saying this isn't making common sense.
Well, you know, that seems to be a recurring theme in my law practice, that I'm not making common sense. Your Honor,
no, I didn't say you weren't. I'm saying this.
I will tell you that it does appear to violate common sense in that circumstance. But let's take the flip side of that. Let's say that a person is in the Tarrant County Jail today, awaiting charges on a criminal case. And somehow he manages to get access to a phone, and he manages to get the phone number of the victim and call the victim. What's the repercussion for that? It could be tampering with a witness. It could be violation of the jail policies. It could be it could be making a terroristic threat. It could be violation of statutes that prohibit the use of pirated cell phones in jail facilities. There's a variety of means by which the law can address that. But the truth of the matter is, if this person calls up the witness, makes a collect call, the victim accepts the collect call, the person says, I just want to tell you I'm sorry. Has there been a violation of the law? Probably not. Doesn't mean that any of us like it. And I wouldn't defend that action by an inmate. But is it a violation of the law? Is it a violation of the law that should result in the absence of anything further, saying that person is then subject to a 10-year sentence in the penitentiary? I don't think so. I just don't think so. There has to be something above and beyond that. In this case, however, I suggest that the Health and Safety Code understood the seriousness of alleging a penitentiary-level violation for an act such as this, and so it said, look, while you're confined, we're a civil commitment organization. We're a civil council. We're not a judicial body. We can't, we're not authorized to make these kind of findings of fact and to have this supervisory contact over you. So therefore, while you're confined, you're off our books. If the case is resolved and you come back onto CSOT, then we continue to have supervision. In this case, he was clearly confined. And by the clear wording of the statute, whether the statute makes common sense or not, CSOT did not have any jurisdiction. And anything that he is alleged in the absence of otherwise being criminal to have done while he's in the Tarrant County Jail would have to be handled by somebody other than CSOT. It's our position they simply did not have jurisdiction. The fact is, in each of these three cases, well, the first one and then the second two, there are different issues. And the fact is, if the court were to find that there was insufficient notice as to case number one and reverse that case, Mr. Miller, having pled guilty, would still have 10-year sentences in the remaining two cases. Conversely, if you found that the indictment was adequate in the first case and found that CSOT lacked jurisdiction in the second two cases, he would still have a 10-year sentence. Only in the event that the court would reverse all three of these cases would Mr. Miller be freed from the penitentiary sentence, and he would still be under the terms of the civil commitment order. He would still be back under the custody of CSOT. So this is not a circumstance where, even if it all worked out to the best possible event for Mr. Miller, would he be free from the constraints that he's now under. I don't envision that Mr. Miller will ever be free of those constraints. I will tell you, I think it likely that Mr. Miller will be continued under the supervision of CSOT until the day he's laid to rest, or maybe beyond that, because of the horrendous facts and circumstances of this case. I'm suggesting to the court that this is a troublesome area. There has been a sea change in the law, which we might personally agree with or disagree with, but a sea change in the law which allows a person who has been sentenced to a penitentiary sentence to discharge that penitentiary sentence. And whether that sentence is too low, too high, too burdensome, that's not before the court. But then after a discharge of criminal sentence, to then be continued under the supervision of the state and held in constructive custody, maybe even confinement, having discharged his penitentiary sentence. That is a huge change in the law. And I would imagine, I'm certainly the oldest among the four of us, but I would imagine that all of us have practiced law long enough to remember that had somebody suggested that we have such a huge and momentous change in the law at the time we started practicing law, none of us would have believed it. We might have thought it was a good idea, but none of us believed that it would come to pass, that we would do that. I say that only to suggest that if we're going to do this, that this statute, has to be administered very, very, very carefully and exactly as set out in the law. I'm not suggesting any sympathy for Mr. Miller. None whatsoever. But what I am suggesting is there's a huge obligation if we're going to do this, if we're going to incarcerate or confine people even after they've served their criminal sentence, that we better hold both sides to the strict letter of the law. Mr. Miller or other appellants similarly situated, but also the state of Texas because of the potential for abuse. And I suggest that there has been abuse in this case by the manner in which this has been accomplished. Now, had I been trial counsel, as I've already suggested, I think I would have done things a lot differently than were done in this case to address this issue of the requirement of the strict enforcement of this law. But I'm stuck with what I'm stuck with, as are you. It's a difficult case. I think it's a set of circumstances that we're going to see again. If we don't fashion a clear understanding of what the parameters are of the authority of this council, which, after all, Your Honors, this is a political council. not a judicial council. This is a political council that is established by politicians. Whether that's good or whether that's bad, I'll leave to your judgment. I have my own feelings as to whether that's the sort of governing body that we want to establish a law of this significance. So, with that, I will yield to Mr. Porter.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Porter?
Counsel, Madam Deputy Clerk, may it please the court. My name is Andy Porter, and I'm honored to represent the state of Texas in this case. Mr. Strickland is correct. The factual and procedural background of this case is rather convoluted and complex, but the issues before this court are very, very, very simple. There are two issues raised by the appellant, but I will address them separately as three issues. Each have to do with whether or not the trial court erred by failing to quash the indictments in these cases. The standard review is de novo, as Justice McCoy wrote just 4 years ago in Laird v. State. When you're looking at an indictment, you need to determine two things in the process of reviewing the adequacy of the indictment. First, does the indictment provide adequate notice to the defendant? And to do so, it needs to plead certain elements. It needs to show the forbidden conduct. It needs to show the required culpability, and it needs to show the required result. In this case, looking at the first indictment, the indictment in that case alleged that Mr. Miller failed to complete his sex offender treatment as required under the order of civil commitment. And by being kicked out of sex offender treatment, that was a violation of the Beaumont District Court's order of civil commitment. The forbidden conduct in that case, in this first indictment, appellate cause number 0209167, was the failing to fully participate in sex offender treatment. The required culpability alleged the indictment was that such conduct was intentionally and knowingly. Arguably, the state could have alleged recklessness. It did not. And that arguably third culpable state would have been permissible under Penal Code Section 6.02 as laid out in the state's brief, but the state did not. It alleged the higher mental states of a couple of mental states of intentionally and knowingly. And then the third element under that indictment required under Chapter 21 of the Code of Criminal Procedure is the required result, and that is the violation. The indictment in appellate cause number 0209167 criminal alleged the three necessary parts. It tracked the language of the statute, and under Chapter 21 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, it provided the appellant with sufficient notice. It is important to remember when you're assessing the adequacy of an indictment that you look to the four corners of that indictment first.
Are you going to address the dates?
Your Honor, I'd like to, yes.
Great.
First,
why don't you get to it at some point?
First of all, I don't think that issue has been preserved for review. For example, at trial, he didn't bring up the dates at all before the trial court. In his written motion to quash the indictment at page 58 of the appellate record, there was no issue brought forth alleging a discrepancy between the dates of the indictment. So possibly this issue has not been preserved for appellate review. The issue he raised at trial was the adequacy of the notice. The issues raising on appeal was internal inconsistencies, and those two issues may not be the same thing. But even if they are the same thing, the state doesn't have to allege a date certain. The important thing in the law of indictments is that the act alleged occurred prior to the return of the indictment by the grand jury and within the applicable statute of limitations, and provides the defendant with sufficient notice such that he is aware of the circumstances surrounding the alleged conduct, and that will also bar jeopardy, that jeopardy will attach to that conduct. And in this case, the indictment provides that. The indictment is not a model of clarity. For example, as Mr. Strickland aptly points out, there are some descriptive phrases within the context of the indictment that a grammarian would call a misplaced modifier. It seems to be that the May 9th date about which he complains could modify the immediately preceding phrase, or it could modify an earlier preceding phrase. And that misplaced modifier does create some confusion within the text of the indictment. However, if you assume that that creates confusion, then you jump to step two of the process of reviewing the adequacy of the indictment, and that is whether or not the appellant actually suffered any harm and was unaware and unable to defend at trial. In this case, he cannot show that. In fact, in this case, the record affirmatively refutes any such claim by the appellant. The record, the reporter's record before the trial court clearly shows that the appellant was aware of the accusations against him and had even brought forth what he wanted to assert as a statutory defense, that being that at the time he was confined at the Cold Springs facility, he was under the confinement of the state of Texas. He was not subject to the Council of Sex Offender Treatments regulation, and therefore he is not susceptible to criminal prosecution in any of these cases. That was his position at trial. Well, that would, by that, the court should know that he was aware of the accusations against him, and he was able to defend those against those accusations. So he cannot meet the second prong of the analysis regarding the adequacy of the indictment. Accordingly, this court should not sustain and should affirm the trial court's judgment with respect to appellate cause number 02-09-167 criminal. Turning on to the second issue in this case, and that being the adequacy of the remaining indictments in appeals 168 and 169. His position on appeal is that he was confined and he was arrested and in jail in August, and that's when those alleged violations occur. And Justice McCoy, you asked the question, does it really make sense that he can harass the victims or violate the court's order and there be no repercussions? That issue's not really before the court, and whether or not
I put it quite that way. I think I put it, can he do things when confined that he could not do when he was free?
My apologies. Right. My apologies, Your Honor. That issue is not quite before this court. Mr. Strickland may be correct and it come up later. But whether or not he can be held criminally liable for those violations is also not before this court. And here's why. Again, the issue on appeal is the adequacy of the indictments. As this court knows very, very well, and as the Court of Criminal Appeals has held, when determining the adequacy of the indictments, you do not look beyond the four corners of the indictment. It's much like the eight corners rule in contracts and insurance defense, except instead of eight corners here, we've got four corners. So you look at that piece of paper, the indictment. In some cases, it's a two-page indictment, or if you're doing a RICO violation, it may be 128 pages indictment. But in this case, it's a one-page indictment, and you look at the four corners to determine whether or not, again, those indictments show the forbidden conduct, show the required culpability, and show the required result. In this case,
what if the forbidden conduct isn't forbidden?
Pardon?
What if the forbidden conduct isn't forbidden? Which
then,
is kind of what he's saying here, is that it's not forbidden because he's confined. I mean, what's your remedy?
In that case, that would be something for the jury to determine as a matter of fact at trial. In this particular,
like a legal question. The legal question is whether this is forbidden or not.
In most cases, Your Honor, you would be absolutely correct. For example, under assault, under Section 2201 of the Texas Penal Code, assault by a contact causing bodily injury, and the state fails to allege that there was any bodily injury or contact at all,
well,
then that would be a legal question.
The jury could find, yep, he talked to his dad, Okay, but the legal question is that forbidden conduct or not? And the judge would decide that's not forbidden. And for this case, I assume the judge would decide whether or not he talked to his dad. Mr. Strickland's position is that's not forbidden conduct because he's in prison. So,
well, I think doesn't it also involve determining what is meant by the duties in civil commitment order are suspended while he's in confinement?
Well,
what does that mean?
Your Honor, to extent you're both absolutely correct, and that's the judge determining the adequacy of the allegation. However, to get to the point where the judge determines he was in confinement, the judge has to first make a factual finding.
That is?
He was confined in a lockdown facility that Cold Springs is a lockdown facility. And if you'll remember from the reporter's record, there was conflicting evidence on that point. There was some evidence that Cold Springs is a lockdown facility, and there was the insinuation that he could not walk away. There was other evidence that he could have walked out of that facility anytime he wanted, but if he did, it would have been a violation. There was that testimony. I apologize. I can't remember the exact page in the reporter's record where that came through. But before you can make that legal determination of whether it applied or it didn't apply, you've got to first make the factual determination of whether it was confined or wasn't confined. And factual determinations are not the province and not the proper time when you're addressing the adequacy of the indictment. That's a place for trial. In this case, the issues are whether or not the issues that were raised at trial were whether or not the indictments were adequate to provide notice. Here, they clearly describe the forbidden conduct, the required culpability, the required result. In the indictment in appellate cause number 0209168 criminal, it alleged that Miller contacted a family member, that being Steve Miller, on October 23rd, 2008. That's the forbidden conduct. The second element, the required culpability, if the indictment alleged that the contact was intentional and knowing. And the third element, the required result, was that such conduct violated the order of civil commitment. So looking at the four corners of that indictment, the indictment alleged everything it needed to do to meet the requirements of Article 21 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. It provided him with constitutionally sufficient due process notice. And the language of the indictment tracked the statute and was such that a person of ordinary understanding could read the indictment and determine what the allegations were. But even if you jump to the second step and say that it was confusing or misleading, then you have to determine whether or not there's any evidence of harm in the record to show that the appellant didn't understand the accusations against him. And when you do that, then you look to the reporter's record of the hearing at the trial below, and it's clear he understood the nature and the cause of accusations against him. I'd also like to take a brief...
You keep talking in terms of notice, but his point is phrased in terms of it does not appear that an offense against the law was committed. Not that he didn't receive notice, but he didn't commit an offense against the law.
And that's
forbidden conduct.
And that's a matter for factual determination. And when you have to have a factual determination, that's when you have a jury of 12 people to determine those facts. In this case, there was no trial.
What question would you suggest that it suggested should be asked to the jury? Was he confined at Cold Spring? Is that the question that the jury would decide?
Yes, Your Honor, because that would negate an element of the offense. And when you have a situation where you have facts that negate the element of the offense and to which the appellant would otherwise be entitled to a judgment of acquittal, that's for the jury to determine.
So are you conceding that if he was confined, there was no offense because these prohibited conduct are not prohibited?
No, Your Honor, that is not the record before us. The record before us is conflicting on whether or not he was confined and was unable to...
That if he was confined, that these civil remedies do not apply in the confined situation? The civil prohibition do not apply when confined?
Under the text of the statute on the Health and Safety Code, the Health and Safety Code does provide a provision that says this application does not extend to places where the defendant is under a period of confinement by the state of Texas.
Okay.
I would like to clear up one thing from the appellant's brief. He says in his brief, and I apologize, I'm out of time. Basically, he says that CSOT is a political organization with no background in sex offender treatment. That is untrue. If the court is able to go online and check the biographies of the members of the CSOT Council, they are all either licensed sex offenders or have 20 years plus experience in treating sex offenders. One is a probation officer and a parole officer. One is a defense attorney with a doctorate in sociology and teaches in the area of criminology. Your Honor, for the reasons stated in the state's brief and for the reasons stated today, we'd ask the court to address the issues within the four corners of the indictment, find that the indictment provided the appellant with adequate notice in all three cases, and affirm the trial court's judgment.
Did you bring to the attention of the trial court that there was a factual question about whether he was confined or not?
Your Honor, I was not trial counsel, but that was not brought to the court's attention from the reporter's record. Of the reporter's
wouldn't
record.
Wouldn't that be your burden to demonstrate to the trial court that this is a question for the jury, therefore you can't make a determination as a matter of law as to whether this is adequate or not?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's really anybody's burden per se. The movement has the initial burden of showing
that in this case he's going to argue that the civil commitment order is inapplicable when confined, and then it seems to me that your response and your burden would be, well, Judge, there's a question as to whether or not he was confined. Maybe not.
I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a burden. If I were the trial prosecutor, I would certainly bring that to the trial court's attention. But as far as a burden.
Okay, well, we've been talking about preserving error. Why do we do that? So the trial court can correct
make those calls.
If it's not brought to the trial court's attention, was there some sort of waiver? Or okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Strickland? Rebuttal.
If I may, I know these always start with briefly, and I intend to try and honor that. There's no getting around it. I think that this entire matter is sloppy from the get-go. That's been kind of in the corner of the room throughout this presentation this morning. The pleadings were sloppy, the enforcement was sloppy, and trial counsel's preservation of the issues, in my estimation. I mean, no disrespect to him, but I think that was sloppy likewise. Indictment number one. And I suggest that the court do what I'm sure it's already done, but let me just emphasize this. Simply read the indictment and ask yourself if this really sets forth with the kind of specificity and notice that we require of indictments to pass muster.
So what about his argument, let's go to phase two, let's go to step two, if we concede that it was vague or susceptible more than one meaning?
Well, if we concede that it's vague and susceptible, all I can suggest to the court is that counsel, and perhaps he should have sought a different vehicle, counsel raised the motion to quash. And if I think the trial court was equally capable of reading this indictment. This judge is an experienced criminal practitioner on both sides and as a judge. Just a simple reading of it. I think even to a layperson, let alone to a lawyer, to a judge, lacks the specificity. We don't know when the offense occurred. The record before the court contains the order of civil commitment.
I guess I was referring to the fact that he was adequately able to defend himself. There doesn't appear that he was harmed in any way, et cetera.
Well, I guess he was adequately able to defend himself if we consider the counsel simply entered a plea of guilty and took a 10-year penitentiary sentence. We don't know because it wasn't there was never then a factual there was nothing factual ever developed aside from the motion to quash. I don't know. I mean, I guess from my standpoint, it depends on which side of the bars you're sitting as to whether or not he suffered the harm. But I understand counsel's point, and I think it's a strong one. I just we just have to deal the hand we're dealt here. This is, in addition to not giving us fair notice, the indictment itself is self-conclusory. It seems to suggest that this man is guilty of the offense by virtue of the determination of the Council of Sexual Offenders, which seems to me to be a huge leap in the authority that's granted that that body, and one that's not contemplated by the statute. I will also say, before I leave indictment number one, that, that trial counsel's reliance on whether or not he was confined at the time that, that we think count one occurred, I mean, case one occurred, was misplaced. He wanted to talk about whether condition having to be housed in Cold Springs was confinement. We're abandoning that. That was just, that is confusing, and I think that, that clearly Council on Sexual Offenders had the right to house him at Cold Springs. And that's an entirely different issue than that presented in the second two cases. But to argue about whether or not they even had any authority in regard to offense number one, I think is just is not valid, and all it's done is confuse us. Then we turn to indictment number two, and I think Justice McCoy, you've hit the nail on the head. The threshold issue here is whether or not he was confined, and whether or not, by virtue of that confinement, CSOT had lost its jurisdiction. All you really have to do is to read the statute, and the statute, even the heading of the statute, makes clear what its intent is, puts us on notice. Effect of subsequent commitment or confinement on order of civil commitment, or confinement on order of civil commitment. Now, this is not the Cold Springs facility, and that's part of the confusion in this case. This is after he's gone to Tarrant County Jail, he's been arrested, and CSOT has said, you're off our books until this is resolved. Then he calls his father, then he calls his brother, and that's the violation. Now CSOT wants to have it both ways and says, well, you're confined, you're off our books, we're not supervising you, we don't have any authority, but by the way, you violated our rules by contacting your father and your brother. They want to have their cake and eat it too, it seems. That's simply not what the statute says. The statute says that once this leaves the treatment area of responsibility, it becomes the exclusive province of the criminal justice system. Let the criminal justice system handle it, then maybe we come back to the civil arena at some point in the future. I suggest that the court read this again, and I suggest that it's just eminently clear that duties imposed by this chapter are suspended for the duration of any confinement of a person by governmental action. An arrest warrant and confinement in the Tarrant County Jail, described in some detail in this record, certainly meets that test. Lastly, let me suggest to the court, I'm not trying to denigrate the credentials of the people who serve on the council, but what I am suggesting is, just as I'm not sure that judges ought to be sex treatment providers, I'm suggesting that sex treatment providers are not equipped by training, education, experience, or temperament to act as judges, which, in the facts of this case in regard to the second two cases, they clearly have sought to do. So it's been a privilege to appear before you this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Strickland. Thank you, too. Thank you both for good briefs and good arguments. Your case is submitted, and we will be standing in recess for a change of panel.